You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, that is also located at Rudolf Steiner Audio, which is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, number 316 in the collected works, entitled Understanding Healing, Meditative Reflections on Deepening Medicine Through Spiritual Science. This is Lecture 4, given in Dornach on the 5th of January, 1924. Now, my dear friends, we have tried to sketch out in the last three sessions the kind of basic knowledge which a physician should try to obtain, knowledge which we could only sketch out briefly as permitted by the short time. But you will have realized that if we wanted to go into detail, it would take a long time. This time would, of course, be available on a medical course. A proper medical course would have to be organized in such a way that an initial part of the course, which would have to comprise at least a year, if not longer, would have to be provided for students in which such knowledge is then acquired as the basis of what medicine is all about. I cannot give you more than a kind of outline of what that should be like. And that is why I want you to consider what I have presented in 3 hours so far as a kind of charcoal drawing of what a physician has to learn. I would like to describe that as the exoteric part of what a physician must know. The next step in the medical course would then have to be the esoteric part of what a physician must know, something which we will speak about now. This esoteric part must build on the basis of the exoteric part. But when you are studying medicine, you should on no account disdain to acquire, with all seriousness, a thorough command of the exoteric part, insofar as we can know anything about it. That is difficult in the present time. But as we will see in the sessions to come, a lot can be done in this direction, particularly through the medical section in our Dornach school. And it is already possible today to expand what I have indicated in my brief sketch by means of the many details which are available in my cycles and writings. That has only happened to the smallest extent so far, and the extension offered by anthroposophical medicine will not come about until the work which I am preparing with the help of Dr. Wegmann is published in the near future. Then it will be possible to see how anthroposophy can provide a stimulus for medicine and medical studies. But you must be clear that the study of medicine is a very special course of study, which has its own special prerequisites, a course of study in which the findings of spiritual science cannot be ignored. We cannot have a system of medicine in which the findings of spiritual science are not present. The chaotic conditions which we continue to encounter in this field simply exist because a school of thought is setting the tone in medical studies and knowledge which is totally unsuitable for an understanding of medicine. Things are such today that we have a science, including in theology, which is only suitable for technical purposes and not in any way for gaining an understanding of the human being. For you see, real medical knowledge requires something special, which will become clear to you when I speak about how the human being is created. I already drew attention to it exoterically yesterday, so today and in the following lessons I will make the transition to the esoteric aspect. The external substances are in reality processes. Salt is only the expression of processes. The magnesium processes, iron processes, are processes which take place outside in nature. Lead processes, mercury processes, are processes which human beings must not have within them, which are outside in nature. But it is only apparently so that human beings do not have these processes within them. How is the human being created? To begin with, the physical base is created through fertilization, and this physical base must combine with the etheric body of the human being. But the etheric body is not created through fertilization, but is formed around what later becomes the eye organization and astral organization, around the spiritual and soul entity which comes down from the spiritual world, and which was present from pre-earthly life. So we are dealing with the actual core of the human being as the spiritual and soul entity, which exists, firstly, from earlier incarnations, and secondly, from the time between death and a new birth, long before fertilization has taken place. This spiritual and soul core of the human being attaches the etheric body to itself before it establishes a connection with what is created through the fertilization of the physical egg. And the thing which unites with the potential contained in the physical embryo, the capital I, the astral organization, and the etheric organization, this threefold organization unites with what has been created through physical fertilization. You must look at the etheric body as something which is formed from out of the cosmos. Now, this etheric body, which is formed out of the cosmos, at the moment when it first unites with the physical organization, contains the forces which then do not apply to the physical organization, the lead and zinc forces. It is only apparently the case that human beings are not a microcosm, in that they do not contain certain substances. The substances which the human being does not have in the physical body are the most important substances for the constitution of the etheric body, so that lead processes, zinc processes, mercury processes, and so on, indeed take place in the etheric body before it is united with the physical body. Then the etheric body combines with the physical body, the other parts as well, of course. And the following occurs to a small extent during the embryonic period, but to the greatest extent when respiration starts, that is, at birth, when real external respiration starts. Then all the forces which the etheric body possesses from the substances which are not based in the physical body are transferred to the astral body, and the etheric body takes on those forces which the physical body processes within itself. So the etheric body undergoes a very important metamorphosis. The metamorphosis that it takes on the content, the constitution of the physical body, and passes on its own constitution, its affinity with the human environment, to the astral body. The astral body is now intimately connected with what human beings can know. And at the moment, my dear friends, when you start to assimilate not just theoretical knowledge, but true, internally digested medical knowledge, at that moment, you bring the content to life within you, which the astral body already possesses, but which has remained unconscious and represents the relationship with the environment. Let me take a specific case. Take a region, for example, which is melancholy. It is melancholy because the ground in the present constitution of the earth contains gneiss. And the gneiss contains mica, which is familiar to you as a mineral. Mica exercises a very strong influence on the local constitution which a human being has in a specific region. Your physical body is different if you are born in a region where there is a lot of mica. It acts on the physical body from the ground, from out of the earth. Now, you will find that a lot of rhododendrons grow in regions where there is a lot of mica. The plant can frequently be found in the Alps, in Siberia, and so on. Rhododendron substance is intimately connected with the etheric body before it enters the physical body in such regions. This affinity with rhododendrons is passed on by the etheric body to the astral body. So, when illnesses occur in such regions, which are caused by a preponderance of the action of mica on the inhabitants by way of the groundwater, the etheric body has passed on what it obtained from the rhododendrons to the astral body. that is present externally in the rhododendron plant. From that we can know that there is a sap in the rhododendron which has a healing effect on this illness. That is why in many things, but not in everything, the specific medicine for an illness can be found in the regions in which the particular illness occurs. Now you have to consider that when you are asleep each night, as a physician, you immerse yourself in your astral body, in the environment that was connected with the etheric body and is now connected with your astral body. When you then acquire medical knowledge, if you know what healing forces exist in the human environment, you experience these healing forces constantly in sleep. In sleep, you constantly experience confirmation of what you can learn externally through dialectics. And that must be taken into account in any medical course, because all external dialectical learning of medical subjects is of no use, is never of use. It becomes dissociated, disordered, if the necessary confirmation within the astral body and the environment fails to occur during sleep. Because if the study of medicine is not obtained in such a way that the astral body can say yes to what the physician has learned in his or her dialogue with the environment, it is as if he or she listened to something which he or she cannot understand, which only confuses him or her. In this way, medical knowledge is intimately connected with those things in the life of the human being which lead into sleep. You see, it really is the case that precisely such things must lead to the conviction that medical studies must be acquired by the whole human being, the living, feeling human being. Because something else arises from this nightly intercourse with the healing ingredients, which can really never be obtained through dialectical learning, the urge to give real assistance. Without this urge, this feeling of the physician, without the concern for the person who is to be healed, without this urge, personally, to give assistance, there is basically no healing. You see, here I have to say something that you might find quite strange and paradoxical. But since you do want to learn about what is missing today and what has to come, I have to say this as well. Because in Dornach we work on the basis of esoteric impulses. You see, I have often been told that it might happen that the medicines we produce, this will appear paradoxical to you, but you will have to accept some things as paradoxical, that the medicines we produce in the pharmaceutical laboratory should be carefully protected so that they cannot be copied. I once responded to that by saying that I was not really too concerned about copies being made, if we succeeded in introducing true esoteric impulses into our stream. Then people would understand that the medicines are made with an esoteric background, that it is not the same thing if the medicines are made with everything which lives in the esoteric aspect, which is introduced thereby, or if any old factory copies them. That may appear paradoxical to you, but that is how it is. It simply is necessary, much more so than something being done by external means, by commercial tricks, that a certain atmosphere is created which says there is something behind that which gives these things a healing power based on the spirit. That is not superstition. That is something which, as you will still see, can be thoroughly substantiated through spiritual science. Thus reasonable people will realize that if the medicines that are produced here are taken, it means that a start is being made with what actually needs to be done. Such objections which have been voiced to me might be the result of people today having no idea that particularly in the medical sphere, esoteric, spiritual life has to be taken much more seriously. As soon as you understand this, above all, you will see the real sense, not just formerly, as happens elsewhere, in which a school, a place to foster medical studies, was to be set up here. You will also understand that the first exoteric medical course should be followed by a second course, which approaches the human being in a preeminently esoteric way, which immerses medical knowledge in what is an attitude in the human being, a medical attitude. Certain personalities have always instinctively sought such a medical attitude. And in the last third of the 19th century, when actually there was very little of what might be called a medical attitude, one could only see such a medical attitude sporadically produced in individual personalities, who were then seen as strange characters. After all, the reputation of the Vienna medical school, with which I really grew up, became so great because essentially this Vienna school took as its basis that part of healing in which therapy is least important, namely pneumonia, where one can do least with regard to the central disease, with regard to treatment. That is how therapeutic nihilism, of which you will have heard, arose. Specifically, the most important of the Viennese physicians very deliberately defended therapeutic nihilism. That is, they took the view medicine does not heal. In a certain sense, Virchow also adopted this view. He took the view that of 100 so-called healed patients, one can assume with 50% of them that they would have got better anyway, whether they were given the medicine or not. And with 30%, one can say that the medicine was directly harmful. With the remainder, the chosen medicine might have worked by chance. That is not me speaking, that is Virchow speaking, one of the medical giants of the last century. I know illustrious personalities even today who strictly hold this point of view, although they might defend therapy. There is no medical attitude in that. But then, the latter cannot be something to which one refers as a mere formality. It must be produced in reality, and for that we require the human element in the second course, which must build on the exoteric aspect. A human element is required, which acts as it did, albeit in a degenerated way, but nevertheless sometimes with what I might call delightful magnificence in such a personality as Paracelsus. Of course, there is a lot one could object to in Paracelsus regarding one or the other point. But he had this medical attitude in a magnificent way. He always knew when he arrived in an area where Rotliegendes was near the surface, came up as earth, that a number of diseases, namely diseases arising from disorders of the blood, were simply due to the fact that the ground contained Rotliegendes. There is a very characteristic development of the pathological process. Footnote with reference to Rotliegendes. Youngest epoch of the Permian Age, the Rotliegendes rocks were created by continental sedimentation, that is, conglomerates of sand and clays and volcanic rocks of all sorts, collected in the lowland basins in the dry, hot climate. The common, but not uniform, red coloring comes from hematite, trivalent iron. The name originates from copper shale mining and describes the second layer under the mined mineral. The first is the Weißliegendes. It is essentially only used for its occurrence in Germany, where it surfaces mainly in the area of Chemnitz-Zwickau, Halle, the eastern Harz, Kiffelhäuser, Magdeburg, but also in the Saarland and Nähe region. End of footnote. There is a very characteristic development of the pathological process. If you are in an area with much Rotliegendes, you will find that the people who have lived there for a long time have become used to the Rotliegendes and display particular characteristics with regard to their temperament. We find that these people have a very active spleen. And if you arrive in that area as a stranger, you will find little liking for you. The people are terribly obstinate, self-righteous, naive. They think you are stupid if you question anything they do. That is how it is. The people become used to it in the Rotliegendes. But if a stranger comes who wants to set up a business, he will not tolerate the Rotliegendes, namely the water. He will suffer certain pathological symptoms. Paracelsus says that such diseases which arise there are also based on the long-established people there. Paracelsus said, something is surely going on in the sphere of the etheric body. Archaeos, he called it. Something must surely have happened to the archaeos before it entered the embryo. Now you always find the laburnum grows wonderfully in these regions. You will easily find a sap in laburnum, in the flowers, the leaves, also sometimes in the roots, which can produce a very good medicine, depending on how the human being is constituted. The point is to obtain a different way of looking at nature as a result of a medical attitude. And so I became acquainted with a physician, I was still a boy at the time, whom you often encountered in the fields and meadows where he communed with the plants, flowers, insects, and so on. Three or four luminaries lived in the area where this person worked as a modest physician. We can say that the work of this modest physician, who so loved the flowers of the field, was incomparably more productive for his patients than the work of the state physicians and the other luminaries. Because they obtained their wisdom from school and the things associated with school, but he truly took his wisdom about medicines from his direct contact with nature. But even this only leads to medical knowledge if you can love nature in every detail. You no longer love it when you study it under the microscope. You have to love it. You have to be able to macroscope it. You see, that is where you learn how necessary it is to make this subconscious life of the astral body available for medical knowledge, to make it properly available. Now, it is by no means my intention to bring up a whole lot of ancient things, but merely to speak about what can be observed in the present. But we simply have to use terminology that has been handed down, because language today, including medical terminology, does not have the right terms. Otherwise, we would have to invent a terminology. Perhaps it would benefit the spread of our views if we did that. But we would probably have to work on such a terminology for years. And since you would like to hear about it right now, I will use the old terminology with some variations. It is a good thing if we first look at the plant world. Not so much because I want to universally recommend herbal medicines, but because we can learn a lot from it and can gain an immense amount, above all with regard to a deeper esoteric view. Now, it is of fundamental importance for learning about medicine that we consider three things, but not consider them in the way that our common knowledge and skills are considered today, but really in a different way. If a student has learned something today, he knows it and thinks, that is good. I know that and can apply it. But the person who is a religiously devout person learns the Lord's Prayer and also gets to know it. But he does not think that it is enough for him to know it, and he prays it daily. He prays what he knows. He allows what he knows to pass before his soul each day. That is a completely different view of the matter, something completely different. Or take an initiate. You can assume with some certainty that he is familiar with the elements of esoteric knowledge. He does not care a fig that he is familiar with them, that he has at some point learned them. It is much more important to him to let the very first elements and the subsequent ones pass through his soul with devotion, so that he always gets new momentum in his soul. The religiously inclined person has quite different experiences from the person who only sees something in nature that belongs to the physical world. We always have to find ourselves again in the rhythm of nature if we want to acquire living and not dead knowledge. Knowledge, the activity of knowing, must be rhythmically repeated. That is what I mean when I say that there has to be a medical attitude as the basis for medical knowledge. Obtaining medical knowledge from the nature of the human being and his or her environment is particularly important in a therapeutic respect. It is of particular importance that you note how you let the plants repeatedly pass before your soul. There are three things in the plant which are of particular importance. The one thing is, and this appears in the plant in a quite wonderful way, the scent of the plant, which is connected with the oils active in the plant. The scent of the plant is the thing that exercises the attraction for certain elemental spirits who want to descend into the plants. And we can, using the terms of the old medicine, truly call this spiritual extract of the plant at work in the scent, which calls forth a kind of longing in the elemental spirits which descend as a result of the scent, the sulfur element of the plant. Because what underlies the scent in its activity, not in its substance, exists in the mineral sphere, in its most concentrated form, in sulfur. We can say that even in just observing the sulfur element of the plant, we obtain a real understanding of the scent of the plant, if we recognize that something spiritual takes place above and below when the plant emits a scent. That is the first thing. The second thing we obtain is an inner feeling for what grows in the leaf. There are so many opportunities to connect the flowers with the scent of the plant, the leaves with the formal element of the plant. The leaves have such diverse forms, serrated, soft, pointed, blunt, segmented, and so on. We should develop a sensitive feeling for this leaf-like aspect in the plant, because that is how these spiritual beings, who descend through the scent, obtain their vitality. And in that way, the endeavor to take on a drop-like form radiates in from the periphery of the cosmos. You see, there is something which can give you a wonderful feeling for what is actually contained in the leaf as the form-giving element from the cosmos. Namely, if you simply develop a love of looking at leaves when in the morning the plants are covered in glistening dewdrops. Because these drops, by their nature, simply reflect the endeavor of the periphery, the cosmos, to produce the spherical form, the drop-like form in plants. It is drops which wholly underlie everything that is leaf in the plant. And if nothing but the peripheral, the cosmic, were spiritually active in the plant, it would always take on a spherical form. You can see that plants become particularly spherical when the cosmic gains the upper hand, as happens in the way some berries are formed and so on, but also in the way some leaves are formed. But such drop formation is immediately taken over by the earthly forces. The drop is stretched in various directions, and a great variety of forms are created. Such striving for a drop-like form can be found in mineral concentration in mercury. That is why in ancient medicine such striving to become like a drop was called mercurial. In ancient medicine mercury was not quicksilver, but the striving to become like a drop, the dynamic striving to become like a drop. The mercurial is present everywhere where there is this striving to become like a drop. Quicksilver is the metal which takes on a drop-like form on earth because the conditions exist for it to do so. Quicksilver has the form on earth which silver has on the moon, where it would also have to be in drop-like form. The point is that ancient medicine called everything with a drop-like form mercury. All metals were also mercury for the ancient medic. That is something which simply has to be taken into account, that ancient medicine lived in what was flexible, vital. We will have to find our way back to such flexibility, vitality. Then you will have to develop a sense which will make you inclined toward this flexible, vital element to such an extent that you tell yourself, when I walk across the meadows in the morning and see the silvery pearls of dew on the leaves, these silvery pearls of dew will reveal to me what lives in the spirit in the leaves themselves, the striving for the cosmic spherical form. But you have to feel that in order to understand plants. You have to learn to understand them in their spherical form. If you learn to understand plants in such a way that you establish a relationship with their striving for the drop-like form, and then upward through the scent, you will gradually acquire a sensitive understanding for everything that acts centrifugally in human beings. Centrifugal forces are at work when human beings cut their nails. They grow again. Those are centrifugal forces which pass through the human being. During the first 7 years, the forces which then reach their conclusion in the permanent teeth are constantly passing centrifugally through the human being. They are expressed to the greatest extent through the formation of sweat. Those things which strive upward in the scent of the plant and attract the nature spirits also live in the scent of sweat, which has a centrifugal direction. So that if you wish to seek what is plant-like in human beings, you do indeed have to look in that direction and assume it to be there in its deep striving outward. In this way, you will obtain a deep and intimate understanding of the connection between what is outside and what is inside the human being. For you see, when the etheric body transfers its particular characteristics to the astral body, the whole thing is reversed. The etheric body wants to develop what it takes from the environment upward. By transferring it to the astral body, it develops centrifugally toward the outside, so that human beings do indeed carry plant-like development within themselves in this respect. Readers aside, I'm going to read that again, and there's a word in brackets with a question mark by it, and I'm not sure why that's there. End of readers aside. By transferring it to the astral body, it develops centrifugally toward the outside, in brackets, downwards, question mark, so that human beings do indeed carry plant-like development within themselves in this respect. Look at the plant, how it seeks its roots into the soil, how through the roots it enters into an intimate relationship with the salts in the soil, in the widest sense. Here a process takes place which is diametrically opposite to the phenomena accompanying the sensory processes, which are salt processes. Take table salt, which tastes salty in solution, and imagine this process turned into its polar opposite so that the solution is reversed. Solidification takes place, and the smell and taste become latent. Then you have the process that takes place between the soil and the plant root. That is what is called the salt process in ancient medicine. Ancient medicine did not call the things salt which we do today, that is, carbonate salts and so on. It called salt what in the plant and the downward pointing root enters into a connection with the substances of the soil. That is the salty element. In constantly directing your attention rhythmically toward these wonderful secrets of nature, you are taking practical steps to fill your medical knowledge with life. In other words, you will start, if you try in this way, to fill your medical knowledge with life, to look at nature and human beings in such a way that healing comes to you from out of the strong impulse to give assistance of which I spoke to you earlier. It can truly only develop on such a basis, quite specifically. These things must be triggered specifically through assiduous, determined, active, exoteric learning. Otherwise, you will only do muddle-headed things. But it is also necessary to know that the real basis of medical knowledge lies, in fact, in this rhythmical absorption in the human natural environment, not in theoretical medical learning, but in what I have just tried to characterize and what you can live rhythmically. What I am about to write on the blackboard is not there for you to know, but to keep stimulating in you such vitalization of your medical sense. It goes something like this. Healing spirits, you unite with sulfur's blessing in the etheric scent. You are enlivened through mercury's striving upward in dewdrops, in what grows, in what becomes. You stop in earth's salt, which nourishes the root in the soil. That is what the soul acquires in looking at the environment, awakening the inner sense for what surrounds it. Human beings can then respond. I want to unite the knowledge of my soul with the fire of the flower scent. I want to bestir the life of my soul through the glistening drop of the leafy morning. I want to strengthen my soul existence through the hardening salt with which the earth carefully maintains the root. Now, my dear friends, what you can acquire through repeatedly bringing these things to life in you, like the pious do in prayer, stimulates those forces in the soul which can work medically. Because the normal forces which are used in school today cannot awaken medical knowledge. The latter must be retrieved out of the soul. That is why I always preface the esoteric observations we wish to foster with this. We have to consider how the soul forces first have to be brought to life in order to awaken in the soul those things that lead to medical knowledge. The end of Lecture 4.